This is The Crucible. The JRTC Experience. This is where we discuss warfighting skills and lessons learned in a decisive action training environment for large-scale combat operations at JRTC.
Hi, I'm Colonel Matt Hardman, the Commander of Operations Group here at the Joint Readiness Training Center. And today we're incredibly fortunate to have General Pappas of Freedom 6, maybe one of the coolest call signs in the United States Army, here today. Sir, thanks for joining us so much. And would you mind just telling us a little bit about you and your background?
No, I appreciate it, Matt. First, thank you for inviting me. And it's great to be here, both on the podcast. But we started the day with the promotion of Dave Gardner, 1 to 2 star, and what he's done here at JRTC, both as a COG and the commander, as he's elevated the training methodology, the approach, but then also as the commander, tying in the community and setting a culture that I think is just wonderful and should be emulated throughout for all senior mission commanders. So it's a great way to start off, and appreciate coming here to see you. So General Drew Pappas, I command Forces Command. I've been in command for just over a year and a half. It is a great command because we get to talk all things Army. And I tell people every day is good karma because I come down here and I can spend time in the field and we look at war fighting. You know, and when you look at the initiatives for the chief and his priorities, war fighting is number one. And that's what we do. When you're monofocused on building readiness of a formation, preparing for the fight tonight and the future fight, it allows you to become very sharp in that approach. And, you know, that good karma comes from coming down here, being out there on patrols with soldiers, seeing how leaders develop the skills that they need in developing both staff and warfighting functions. Takes us out to the pre-command courses. And everybody's excited because you came in to be a commander or command sergeant major and you get the opportunity to talk to that audience. And, you know, that excitement is often tempered with a little anxiety because the depth of the responsibility that they're about to undertake. So having a discussion of what that means, and that anxiety is actually healthy and it's natural because we've all been through that. Now, how do you work through that and develop the logical progression of prior to command, in command, and through command to develop that team and build it to the highest level of readiness, and what that entails in terms of leadership? And every touch point is a positive one. Because it's about war fighting.
Yes, sir. So, can you tell me a little bit about your background and sort of where you grew up, where you went to school, yeah, and your Army career, sir?
Yeah. So I grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin, and if you're looking I went to West Point. Coming out of high school, West Point. Nobody from my high school or town had gone there, so it was not a long lineage. The lineage of my family would be in the Greek Army. My father came over in '45 at the end of World War II as an immigrant. He was a 14-year-old boy, came across on a ship, naturalized from my grandfather's side, ends up through New York into Philadelphia. And then he himself gets drafted as he's learning English, learning to be an American. They said, congratulations, it's the 50s, you're an American, and he gets drafted. But he knew war. I mean, he'd lived through Nazi occupation, and he understood the challenge of what war entailed. But he took a lot of pride in being an American and the opportunities that this country provided for him and then later for the family. So he served proudly. What was unique, though, since he was obviously of Greek descent, native speaker of Greek, could speak a couple other languages and English. He moved into counterintelligence. So they put him over in Germany. He was still divided. He had the Russian sector, the German. So in counterintelligence and intelligence, there's still a lot of displaced people after World War II. You know, 5 years later, just millions that were still in that area. So he could operate freely in these different areas and pass as a native speaker. And that gave him a lot of access and freedom of movement to operate in those areas. So it helped in terms of intelligence collection and movement. And it was over there while he was there. My mother, her family is also of Greek descent, but they came over just before the war. She, after getting her degree at Marquette University in journalism, wanted her own little excitement. So her excursion, she went over to Europe and worked for government as a journalist and such, happened to be over there and on a mission that my father was on where they were pulling, they had a Russian signal officer, lieutenant. and he had defected. And by dad's story, he had large debts because of gambling. So he had to leave, so he ran to the American side, but he wasn't going to talk. And a signal officer, you know, knew all the codes and such, unless they got his East German girlfriend out. So it was my dad's job to penetrate over into the Russian sector, find this East German woman, and then come out as a couple. So as they came out of East Germany, now traveling in the West, my mom-to-be just happens to be in the same train in the car that my father and this woman that they're passing off as husband and wife, and he meets her. And
that is
he fell in love.
That's an amazing story, sir.
But it's hard to go back when you introduce somebody as, hey, this is my wife. And then later says, hey, by the way, I'd like to meet you. He says, wait a second. Didn't I just meet you with your wife? And he can't tell why, but it worked. Pretty smooth operator. But what he did imbue in all of us, and I have an older sister, Athena, and she's a cardiologist. I call her the pride of the family that's out there, incredible person, Providence. My brother, older brother by 3 years, he went to NYU film school. He's out in L.A. Following his passion. And then I came in the Army. And it's just something for each of us. What our parents really inculcated in the family was, be grateful we're here. Here's what America means to this family. Here's the opportunities that it presented. And what my dad always told us was, you will be judged by the merit of your character, your judgment. And the only limiting factor in this country, and you say this, is your own initiative. That's the only barrier. You know, there's not a caste system. He said, so whatever you can achieve, you'll be able to, if you're willing to work to it. And that, you know, for me, it was the military.
Yes, sir. And so you went to West Point and then commissioned as an infantry officer, sir. Where'd you first serve as a lieutenant?
Well,
I know it's probably hard for everybody to imagine that, you know, you were a second lieutenant one day, but
I was.
You were.
Like you say, you know, it's not the Civil War, we didn't buy our commission. So I was a proud officer, and I came out as an infantryman. I was going to 8th Infantry Division. So, you know, it's not even existing anymore. So I go to the basic course, off to Ranger School. At the basic course, they had every officer over 6 feet tall report to a room. And I went in there with a couple peers, and it was the old guard.
Yes, sir.
And I said, and they talked to us, and I remember, I won't even say the battalion commander's name, Lieutenant Colonel's there. I said, hey, look, I'm the guy that used to feign injury to get out of Praden. I'm happy with Germany. Ranger School, come out of Ranger School. 8 of us get called out, and we got held up out at Dugway. That's when that was still, because of weather, we couldn't get back. We come out, and they call 8 of us out, my old West Point roommate, Werner and Ganny, and we report to the admin building. And they said, hey, gentlemen, all of your orders are changed. You're now reporting to the old guard. And I was like, boo. You know, I'm going to Germany. You know, you can't do this to me. And that's where I went. So I called up there and said, look, that's not what I agreed to. That's when I thought my vote mattered, and I've learned throughout the years it often doesn't. And I had the company commander, and I reflect back. Remember, it's the last day of Ranger School. We got held over out in Dugway. We came back, graduated, then we're clearing. So as all this goes on, they tell you your orders are changed. So I call him. It was the Captain Rodriguez, and I remember on the phone with him. I said, look, I didn't agree to this. I'm going to Germany. I want to talk to the commander. You can't do this to me. And finally, he's like, hey, Lieutenant, we'll see you in a week. And he hangs up. So I had a pretty kind reception when I did arrive. But I went there, and it was just like anything else. Where you go, it was a great environment. Now, we didn't get to the higher level collective training, not the primary mission, but we did have the opportunity at the lower level. As you were a platoon leader, you developed and you had your training cycle, and it was a very deliberate cycle system. Obviously, you have Arlington Cemetery, you have the ceremonial side, and that is the primary mission, but you had to keep your infantry skills. When you had time to train, you got to develop your own training regimen cycles. You had guys from above, but executing at the lower level. So I learned a lot there. Leadership is leadership anyway, and it's great soldiers that are out there, the same challenges. You develop your own strength as a leader. And that was my first assignment, and went from there to the advanced course. And then I'll tell you, the advanced course, again, the story of my life. Truth be told, I was looking, a number of my peers put SF packets in. The deputy commander said, hey, stay infantry. And I actually went to a headhunter once. I said, hey, I'm looking to get out. He said, stay in. Don't go SF. Don't get out. be a company commander. Just lead, be a commander at that level and understand it's different. Give the Army another, you know, that opportunity, and you take that challenge to lead. And he said, where would you want to go? I was a single man. I said, sir, if you get me to Hawaii, I'll stay. And, you know, it's not like a barter, so it's not like I had leverage. But he said, okay. So I'm excellent. Because I figure wherever you go, you're going to work hard. But Hawaii is a tropical paradise. Get through the advanced course, graduating in January, right after the Christmas break. We get called in, then we get a note. You know, everybody with orders to these locations report to the auditorium. And the branch rep is there, the major. I won't say his name. I worked for him later. And he comes in and goes,
oh. Well, sir, I had the same experience. I worked for my branch officer later, General Bernabe.
Oh, did you?
Yes, yeah. Sir.
Yeah. Well, but General Bernabe is a much more kind and caring, empathetic leader.
Yes, sir.
So this guy, and I like him. He came in, he's like, all you captains with orders to Hawaii, it's over strength. Pack your bags. You're going to Korea. And I'm like, that's not a tropical paradise. And he said, all you single officers going to Korea. And I'm like, hey, sir, marital status can't be a determining factor, you know, or some of that fact. So he stops and everybody looks like, ooh. And he walks over deliberately just to know, like the executioner. He's like, all right, smart. Were you CONUS or OCONUS as a lieutenant? The old guard. I said, sir, I was CONUS. He goes, okay, one more question. Window or aisle? Pack your. And everybody's like, ah, ha, ha. But they couldn't condense it in time because the shots, the movement. So they said, but your airborne ranger qualified. You're not going to Hawaii. You're going to Bragg. And it was the best thing that happened to me as a young captain. And I showed up there, and it was a healthy environment. It was conducive to learning. The non-commissioned officers were extremely, extremely proficient and professional, and a sense of urgency in everything that was done. And I learned exponentially the profession when I was there. And I knew it. You know, you're a lieutenant, you're learning your profession at that echelon, but it was at the 82nd, as a young captain, as the assistant brigade S4, the most coveted position everybody looks forward to. But I learned, and then I got to command, line command for 2 years, and then go to the jump master school that's there for that fifth year. I loved it. I walked out. That was transformational for me, commanding that company. He was right. I'm glad I listened to that mentor. Everything he said was correct, and I found the 82nd to be that environment that if you're willing to work hard and you're willing to listen and learn, you know, you will become a better officer, and you will learn this profession as a junior officer.
Yes, sir. So I had a similar experience serving as a company commander at the 82nd. I didn't get to be the brigade assistant S4, but I did get to be a battalion S4.
Let's be clear, it's very competitive.
Yes, sir. So at the 82nd, was that your first time coming to the Joint Readiness Training Center, sir?
It was. And again, in that coveted billet, it was the first rotation at Fort Polk. 3rd Brigade, 82nd, was the inaugural one as we moved from Chaffee.
Yes, sir.
And myself and a guy named Brian Sneddon, who's on the ForceCom staff now in the J6, who was in the 3 shop, I was in the 4. We were the advanced party because we had to set the conditions for the brigade to come in, and we were going to jump forward. And it was incredible because, you know, today the processes, even the buildings, the motor pools we had to move into, the rail yard wasn't the same. I mean, if you go back to that time frame, you know, a lot of it was learning through execution and the initiative, the formations, because the protocols weren't set. I mean, to the point when one of the formations was supposed to be out of a motor pool as element was for the unit, the rotational unit, to move into. Well, they were still in there. I said, hey, you got to be out today. And they're like, well, we're not going to make it. It's not going to happen. And I remember, I think it was, went to the chief of staff here and I said, hey, we need space. The rotation is coming in. He said, what do you mean? And he called down there and said, get out. You know, so, but everything was, there's always friction. But we worked through it and we learned, and it was a great rotation. Then I came back and I did 2 rotations as a company commander. And that was, people say, oh, it's great. If you're not enjoying it, you know, you're in the wrong thing. It's Brigade Assistant S4, I didn't enjoy it.
Right, sure.
Jesus. Like every day was crawling on sandpaper. But I learned a lot. And, you know, tenacity to get through it. And working with a guy like Brian Sneden was great. I came back as a brand new division company commander. Bruce Parker was my first OC. Bruce Parker, who later commanded, you know, the 05.
Was my battalion commander as a company commander, sir.
Absolutely professional, doctrinally based. And that was my first introduction to a person really of his caliber that worked with me. You know, and I see him every day. We're 50 feet from each other now. I learned so much from him. TTPs of execution, you know, how he battle tracked, how he took reports, how to have better visibility at the company level, how to synchronize better with the battalion, how do I communicate better with them, how to find opportunities at the time. And again, the fight's beyond my company. So looking down and in, got it. How do you look up, out, and then cross coordination with Stammer, my brother company commander, and John Bell Edwards, who's now, you know, the governor of Louisiana.
Sure.
Those are my peers of company. We're collaborative, but Bruce really taught me how to be a better company commander. And this was early in my command time. And then I came back again, Drew Meyer, which was my second one. Now I'm at the tail end of command, and he helped refine where I was at. And he elevated my thinking, just as Bruce set that foundation. Drew Meyer, which elevated it, because he had the multiple rotations, and now he's starting to say, hey, here's how you gotta, you know, think as a field grade, act as a field grade, and here's how you fight the fight by looking at a larger spectrum. Every touch point, I got better.
You know, sir, I mean, as you described that, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, that I took away from my experiences here as a player is just the degree that, you know, as a younger officer, I used to think, well, I'm going to go there and I'm going to learn about what I'm doing right now. And now in retrospect, looking back, I realized the things I learned that not only prepared me for what I was, you know, doing in that job, but was really preparing me for second and third jobs down the line. So you spent a lot of time. You've been the Force Comm Commander here for a year and a half. And as you're focusing our formations on Train for LISCO, you know, where do you think we've had the most growth up to this point?
In my tenure, I look at the growth that we've had. First, let me tell you that General Garrett, as he came into the role, he reflected, he came down, and these are great test sites because you can see gaps in training because it's execution. Foundational readiness. Squads and platoons not winning the first fight. Remember, we were elevating up a gated strategy. Not bad in philosophy, but you got to get to this higher level collective training before you came here. But it didn't give time for retraining or the reintroduction of soldiers every month to get new ones. So at the 6 months, you could have a pretty large turnover in your formation. But now you've already elevated to a higher level collective. You haven't got down to those bases. General Garrett expertly identified that, so we got to get back down to the foundational readiness. When you walk out here now and you see it, when they jump in tonight and they execute, they are winning that first fight because they've done those foundational readiness tasks. The soldiers, the team leaders, the squad leaders, platoon, up to company, execute that. Where I saw a gap, and it's not ubiquitous, but some of the formations, we win that first fight, but it's drawn the energy and the focus of the battalion, even the brigade at times, into company-level fights. And then we win it, you know, we high-five on the objective, you know, and we just hit 10 home runs in the first inning and we high-five. Well, you got 8 more innings. But we weren't doing simultaneous planning over different planning horizons. We were not being predictive in the transitions. We're getting drawn into the first fight. So when that happens, we win it, but then we stop, and it's a sequential planning. Well, Geronimo and any good adept enemy, they're moving faster. So though you won the first fight, they're now operating in a faster OODA loop, and they were getting the upper hand after that.
Yes, sir.
And it put us on it off balance as a formation. So where we wanted to push and where we drove it, and I'm seeing it now, quicker than I actually anticipated, by the way, we got to get the battalions to be predictive. We've got to get them to synchronize the war fighting functions. We've got to set the conditions for the lower formations to transition. And, you know, from the offense to the defense, like we talked about yesterday, do you have your class 5 resupply? Do you have your class 4 in position? Do you have your engineers set? Have you predicted on the terrain what's most advantageous to set up your engagement area and stop before you culminate?
Yes, sir.
And then you're already transitioning. in order for the battalion to do that, they got to put the demands on the brigade that owns some of the resources to execute that and capabilities to shape, you know, beyond the capability of the battalion. I've seen the battalions move very quickly in executing that. I thought it'd be 2 years till we got a baseline for the battalions to do that. But through the LTPs, the training, the home station training that they've done, and through multi-echelon trainings, you can't give more time and you can't walk away from the foundational, the battalions are coming in much better prepared. At this level, I'm very comfortable with where we're at the battalion, and we'll continue to grow. And the brigades also, so when the battalions have gotten that level of proficiency, they're generating the demands on the brigade, which is forcing that brigade staff to have that same level of proficiency and professionalism in order to meet the demand of the battalion. Otherwise, the battalion will outrun them. And it's a bigger staff. So I'm glad with the trajectory that we're at the battalion and the brigade while maintaining that foundational leadership.
Yes, sir.
The foundational proficiency that General Garrett identified.
You know, I agree with you with the time. And the speed at which, you know, I think we're making growth. And we got to spend some time yesterday with Colonel Thornall, the 159 commander. The adaptation to command post size and functionality. Yeah. People, you know, units are responding well to this. I think the other thing, sir, and it sort of goes back, you were describing your own experience as a company commander and a staff officer in the Panthers, is that, you know, this generational change that occurs when, you know, this rotation 182, I've seen some of these captains three times. They've been here as guest OCTs. They did a rotation here, and then a year later, they're no longer a staff officer and as a company commander. And it gets in the DNA of the formation, and particularly when, you know, home station multi-echelon training, now doing it here at full, you know, speed is pretty fun to see. Where are you seeing the gaps, sir? Where, you know, as you we've kind of gotten to this place, you know, identifying the transitions of areas for focus, sir.
So one thing you identified a moment ago, the multi-rotations here, which is an environment that is allowing you to develop and grow. It has the professional up for, it has professional OCTs, the guest OCTs get better. This is the environment that you have the ability to do that at a much quicker echelon, and the feedback mechanisms are there. Home station training that. And here's what the CTCs provide. You're validating your level of preparedness and building upon that. And I like the guest OCTs. What I've always loved about the OCTs, and I'll use by name Phil Kinnery, coming out, trying to get him a joint job. We didn't realize he was picked up early, so he didn't have the time to spend. So on the joint side, so he came down here. Then we harvested, he was a company commander for me, and we harvested him back into the 101st. But just the way that he spoke, that doctrinal base that you provide, with then the experience on top of that, that's what a professional, that's how professionals speak. And then with the actual execution, they can visualize what that looks like. And I said, look, if you're going to do something that would violate doctrine, first know what the doctrine is, and then tell me why. Hey, I'm, or a principle of war. I'm not gonna have mass. Here's one of the principles, but here's why I'm gonna violate it, because it doesn't apply to this environment. To me, that's a professional. If you know why you're doing it and you put rigor and thought to that, then I'm good for that. We're not a lockstep army, you know, it's not a phalanx that moves. But you got to have that understanding baseline. That's,
yes, sir.
When you send OCs down here, you drive that, and they communicate well, and they know how to teach it also. So that is a professional developmental option and opportunity for being here. As for the gaps that we have right now, I think our training methodology is building on that, and we're going to fill these gaps, battalion, brigade. I do think that we're elevating up by 3-0 to the division as the principal tactical formation. I think the gaps that we have now, we have to first look at what is our structure. And as you know, for transformation contact, we're taking 3-10 and we're testing a life formation. Same thing with 2-101 with the mobile. But part of that is, what is the right structure? But that's the physical structure. What is the equipping we have to have in order to make that an effective formation? But then also the staff. I think the area that we have in a gap, and this is now to the division level, since it's elevating up, we're fighting domains that we didn't. So you can't go back to the 90s. Everybody's like, oh, it's too. It's not, because we didn't have to have a space capability.
Yes,
we didn't fight in that domain at the division. We damn sure didn't fight at the brigade. Cyber is now a critical domain to fight them. The soft integration that you're doing is much greater than before. we don't have that expertise in our formation. And we have to figure out what echelon we're going to fight it at. You know, where's the MDTF fit in? Is it a division? Is it a corps? Is it a theater capability? But even if it's not at the division, you're going to have expertise at the division on space-based capabilities in order to put the demand on higher to have a full understanding of what their capabilities are and how to request those. Because can't you, hey, set conditions for me. What conditions? What effects do you need? You need experts to do that. And that's from soldiers to warrants to officers. And there's intellectual rigor that has to be put to that. And what does that structure look like? That's the gap moving to the future that I see. Now, the division fight, that's a gap that we have because we're migrating our formations and also your principal tactical formation of the division. But we're addressing that with our divisional rotations. And we've done three now. The last one was 1st Armored Division. 3ID was the second one we did. These were both at NTC. And we've learned from each one the structure around. Take the division headquarters, functional brigades that often don't deploy, you know, as a homogeneous entity. When's the last time a sustainment brigade went to the field? But now you take them out there and you do that and they get back to that field craft. An aviation brigade, getting the cab out in the field, distributed, being able to execute planning operations in a field environment. We put the DeVardi out there. But the DeVardi, not the tube artillery and the battalions below, but then we EDRI'd MLRS battalions and HIMARS battalions, because that's what the DeVardi is going to utilize for the divisional fight. And then having them synchronize that, and NTC was great, and you've got Air Force here, because you got Creech right there. And they have their red flag exercises, and nesting with those, you're getting a joint fight. SOFs in there, SVABs in there, 11th ACR working as an indigenous force, and a Marine battalion operates at four. But you need all those impulses to fight the division fight and survive, just like here in a ubiquitous battlefield where anything can be seen, in an EW and the evil things that your
Roger,
Lair does. You know, we've got to be able to operate in that environment, defend against drone swarms, utilize drone swarms. You can only do that in these type locations. That's the gap that we have, that we're building to, and we have a methodology to get there.
Yes, sir. And you know, the I think you know part of that is figuring out as a brigade how to fight within a division. You know, the division's got to obviously, you know, there's things that we have to learn, as you described, at the division level, but then at the brigade level, how do I operate not as an independent brigade, but really as part of a division with adjacent units, with those sustainment brigades and those functional brigades.
And the adjacent units are critical.
Yes, sir.
Because how do you coordinate and synchronize between those the units? It's not just for hire to do that for you, but how do you set that up so that you can work in unison and be complementary?
It's, you know, I listened a little bit to your conversation with our space officer serving on the 21st Airborne Division staff, and I think this is such a fun time to be in the Army. We got a lot of, you know, a lot of challenges, and it's definitely a dynamic environment, but I think the opportunity to make an impact is maybe, you know, is definitely an inflection point for individuals to be able to make an impact and help shape what we look like, as you were describing, sir.
It absolutely is. And you use 73 or World War II of these times of transformation in the Army. You're at that point now, coming out of the 20 years of continuous conflict, brigade-centric counterinsurgency, moving back to LISCO, but not the LISCO of the 90s, the future. And we've got to get it right.
Sir, so, you know, and you got a chance to talk with one of our Op 4 commanders yesterday, who was describing how he got tuned up pretty good by 141 here last year. And we see a lot of winning here. The challenge is, how do we aggregate those wins, you know, at echelon, make it systemic and repeatable? How are you seeing examples of that within, you know, force comm units, that they're able to aggregate wins to be successful?
When, and, you know, winning is learning, obviously, but that sounds great. But when you can destroy the enemy in detail, that means that, you know, you also
want to win on the battlefield.
Yes, sir. And the way that we aggregate that, and we have to propagate against the formation, you know, in the formation yesterday, and he had to do it because it was Andy Kaiser's brigade who's with me. So you saw him puffing up his chest. I think he went and lift bench this morning and doubled his weight. But what was the winning? Why? Take a step back. Why were they so successful in the execution of their task? First, adjacent units, cross coordination, that are complementary. Early engagement area development, this again, being predictive in the transition, understanding the culmination point, where to best defend against in preparation for the counterattack. And I talked to the commander, and I said, he said, well, historically, if I can move within 24 hours, I'll catch them in transition. Well, they were predictive. They had pushed class 5-4. They pushed class 4. They knew the terrain. They dug in. Engineer assets right there. So they dug in. They knew where the dismounts went. So when they attacked, they also deceived them. They committed early because they thought it was 9-row concertinas single. And then they were able to strike them because he had an integrated layered fires plan also. So why was he successful? And then 3CR Bradley out in NTC, it was the exact same thing. He identified when he was going to culminate on a movement to contact. He stopped early. He dug in. The next morning, the Op 4 came across, not realizing that he had brought his tank battalion forward and dug them in, and they drove right into his engagement area because expertly set up. What's the lesson there? You outstaff them. Command initiative. The vision of the fight for the future, and then setting the conditions, always planning over time horizons, and getting the whole formation not focused on the immediate, because you got a big enough staff, they're good. Company commander's got that fight. Doesn't need the battalion commander out there fighting his 9 mil. But tank commander needs back there. You know, there's a part for him at the TAC, but that staff is looking, okay, what's happening? What are my intel feeds? Where's my next fight? Where are my points that I can exploit and then take advantage of? That's where I'm seeing the development. So when you talk about what's winning, why did he meet success out there and destroy the enemy? Why did they do it at NTC? And you pull those are the lessons and realize if that's what you can replicate and how do you replicate it, that's what winning is.
Yes, sir. The fundamental readiness that you describe is the foundation, I think, to put units in a place that they're able to think, to see what's coming next, to do. And I love the way you said that, sir, you know, to outstaff the other side. Geronimo's staff's actually really small. And that's, you know, that brings the weight and the synchronization to bear 24, 48, 72 hours in front.
Get your warfighting functions synchronized. We'll win at the bayonet.
Yes, sir.
But let's bring the might of America to bear at the right time and place and deny the enemy the ability to bring his to bear.
Yes, sir. Sir, so you got the chance yesterday to spend some time with Geronimo, and I know you've been out at the National Training Center. What are your thoughts on how the Army and FORSCOM units are approaching innovation right now?
Well, innovation isn't a unilateral entity that you have. It's at echelon. And I said, we've got a futures command, and General Rainey is doing marvelous things. And you can go down and see the innovation labs. And he's got, you know, a phalanx of PhDs. But look at the innovation at echelon. You know, there's initiatives that affect the formation. From the newest soldier who's got a great idea, the squad, the platoon, you know, every post now has an innovation lab. There's a physical one where you're building, you know, an actual physical capabilities, or there's also digital ones. But it's an area to bring forward and identify these are things innovatively that we can utilize in the battlefield. And I'll tell them, look, we don't need everybody developing UAVs. I'd give that to the professionals that Jim Rainey has. But tell them this is a demand across the formation, and he puts the demand out there. So at Echelon, develop that which you can innovatively that meets your Echelon requirement. And if it's a good idea, we can pass that higher. You know, I don't expect them to build it in their garage.
Yes, sir.
You know, type, you know, whatever UAV. But innovation, but it's innovation first. You know, we were talking mechanical in this realm. There's innovation in the technical realm. Chief Lair developing his capability to pick up in the EW spectrum. I mean, he did that from Amazon products. Incredible. And he put it on a UAV that he built. But there's also innovation in our formation. Now, we're setting that up for success right here with 310, with 2-101, and then 2nd to the 25th. So we're giving them the opportunity to test. Let's give them the material solution. Let's give them the structure. So we said, you know, we're not using our CAV squadron anymore, but we need to use a technology base so that your first touch point's not the human, but, you know, some type of integrated machine. Okay, so let's give that to them to test. That's innovation also through execution. So that's the learning that we're going through at this time. And everybody owns part of that.
That's
everybody
true.
Has great experience as leaders. Now we have to capture that and then we glean it. That doesn't make it a lesson learned. It makes it an initiative. And then we've got to test it again. And there's elements that can test it in a controlled environment.
Yes, sir. And, you know, I think the other part of it, you know, we're fortunate, I had 3rd Ranger Battalion down here in December. You know, some of it's like adapting and innovating with our graphic control measures and the way that we, how we're going to fight some of these formations based on changes with sensors and capabilities as well. Sir, what advice would you give a brigade commander as they're preparing their formation for combat training center rotation?
Well, first I'd let them know that I see a CTC rotation as an opportunity to validate their unit's readiness. You know when your rotation is, and you have a training methodology that brought you to this level. And, you know, from the individual all the way up to lower level enabling tasks up to the higher level collective. But then come down here and use it as an opportunity to drive your formation to betterment. And you've got a sparring partner. And this is a sparring partner that's going to refine your capabilities at warfighting. Where you are good, they're going to make you better. Where there's a gap you might not have identified, they'll exploit. But then learn from your mistakes, because you can reset it and learn through execution and identify it. Be very open. Okay, we've got a gap. Take the time, work with the OCs, they'll reset and then execute it again. Even a third iteration while here under the crucible of a CTC, because walking out of here, again, where you are good, you need to be great. Where there's a gap, you need to have solved it and be good. You can work on the greatness later. And then take those lessons when you learn, and then in your retraining and your next training methodology moving forward through your training plan, focus on those areas and continue to build on them. This is the opportunity, validation of where you've been, and an opportunity to give you a path for where you're going in the future. It's not a report card. It's an opportunity.
Yes, sir. Sir, thanks so much for joining us. It was great to see you again down here at the Joint Readiness Training Center, and appreciate your words this morning at General Gardner's promotion. Yeah. Thanks for spending time with us yesterday and today, and look forward to seeing you back down here, sir.
I do too. Thanks, Matt. I appreciate this opportunity. Thanks, brother. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on The Crucible, the JRTC experience.
The Joint Readiness Training Center is the premier crucible training experience. We prepare units to fight and win in the most complex environments against world-class opposing forces. We are America's leadership laboratory. Again, we'd like to thank our guests for participating. This podcast was created and produced by Mr. John Mabes. It was recorded and edited by Chief Thomas Rich and researched by First Lieutenant Anthony Cho. Intro vocals were done by Mr. Robert Chopper. Special thanks to Captain Jermaine Branch and Mr. Jeff England from Public Affairs. Be sure to like and follow us on social media to keep up with the latest warfighting TTPs learned through the crucible that is the Joint Readiness Training Center. Follow us by going to https://linktr.ee/JRTC. We'd like to thank our partners at the Center for Army Lessons Learned of the Combined Arms Center, especially the JRTC Call Observations Detachment. Be sure to follow them on social media as well. Follow them at https://www.army.mil/CALL. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review us wherever you listen or watch your podcasts, and be sure to stay tuned for more in the near future. The Crucible, the JRTC experience, is a product of the Joint Readiness Training Center.